Welcome back to Get Lit, the literary podcast where we discuss famous works of literature and the authors who wrote them. I'm your host, Steph Svars, joined here by my co-host,
John Stricker.
And we are currently live! Woo! We have our paid audience here. We are so excited to be here today at the Pile Bookstore. This is a second of our live shows that is in a bookstore, and we are so excited to be here. This has kind of become a bookstore tour. And we are so grateful to Rebecca and to all of the staff here who made it possible for us to come. If you guys are in the area and looking for a new bookstore to support, we would highly recommend coming out. They have a beautiful selection of all different kinds of books, very cozy environment with a beautiful couch at the front of the store that I am excited to sit in at some point, and all kinds of things, along with some tasty treats and coffees. So we're absolutely delighted to be here with them, and hope that all of you, whether you're coming to us remotely, in person, or beyond, will be able to stop by and support a local bookstore. They've been open since mid-February, and we would love to have this be the first of many exciting years for them to come. So thank you so much to Rebecca and the Pile Bookstore for hosting us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I have a small warning for Rebecca and the Pile Bookstore. If the fact that you have a couch to sleep on and beverages here and a bathroom, Stephanie might never leave. So thank you for having us, and maybe you'll have a long-term guest here.
Yes. So today we are very excited to be talking to all of you about the Literary Ladies of London. This is, I guess, a topic that we've strung together featuring different authors from all over time. We're going all the way back to the 1600s through the 1900s and kind of everywhere in between to learn a little bit more about famous female writers, or maybe not so famous female writers, their contributions to literature, but through the lens of London, looking at things like geography and the places. So I don't know if any of you or you have been to London, but hopefully this could expand for those of you that are going to go or maybe would plan to go to be able to see some new sites through this literary lens. We are huge fans of literary tourism here at Get Lit, and are delighted to talk about them today.
I completely agree, Stephanie, and maybe one day we'll even be able to take Get Lit to London. We'll see.
We are accepting donations.
That's right.
So we're going to kick things off. Normally on our Get Lit episodes, we start out with a news report, but because we're doing live shows, John actually translates his role as news reporter to game master. So at the end of this episode, we will have some games that John will lead us through. You can participate, you can ignore them, it is your choice. But listeners, you're more than welcome to chime in too. They're always a good time. But we'll then actually just go ahead and get started with our first lady. Actually, no, I lied. We're going to get started because Get Lit celebrated our fifth birthday this past week. On this episode, we didn't actually get a chance. John was actually down in Southern Illinois viewing the eclipse. So on our recorded episode that you heard, we had one of our guest hosts, Dan, come join us. So we haven't really been able to chat together about like how cool and exciting 5 years of this podcast is.
Happy 5 years, Stephanie. It's hard to believe that it's been that long, and taking a look at Jack's well-curated slides, we got some numbers to celebrate here about 5 years.
Yeah, so if you are here, you've got the slides in front of you. If you're at home or on the live thing, actually, I don't know if you can do these things at the same time, but we have posted all of our statistics here that you can take a look at that kind of give you a little bit of a year in review of our podcast. So as of today, a week ago, we had over 65,000 downloads of our different episodes, which has been really cool. We're at episode 278 at this point between all of the work that we've been doing. And we've done a ton of different live shows and events and alternative formats, which has been really good. We also celebrated our very first audiobook project this year. We did an audiobook version of A Christmas Carol, which was super fun. You hear all three of our voices, Jack, John, and myself, and a handful of actor guests, and that was really fun to put together and really awful to edit. But we will keep doing it again. And we've also had the privilege this past year of adding another team member. Jack was added this year. Please applaud.
As editor, I will be cutting that applause. Thank you so much.
As the person person who uploads it, I'll put it back in.
Good.
But Jack has taken a ton of work off of my plate and helping edit every single week, and doing a lot of work with the research and putting together also the slides that you're about to see today. And so, like, work on this podcast, I don't know that it's been kind of a really tough year, and I'm not really sure why that is for me personally. And I don't know that Gitlit would be here for you today in the same capacity if Jack had not swooped in the beginning of the summer and helped us really pick up the podcast. It's made it a lot more tenable for me to continue doing. I've been editing and writing this podcast for 5 years, which has just sort of become what I do every week. And it's been really, really nice to get a little extra time back to then give it to my students at school. So I appreciate Jack deeply for all of the work that they do on this podcast.
Here's to 5 more years, Jack.
Yeah. wonderful. Cooking right along, moving right along. We also can jump to the next one. We are in our 6th season, which will be very cool. Our seasons are a year long. So although we're turning 5, it's our 6th season.
That's right.
I have a really hard time with that now.
Right.
So this is mostly for myself to do. And our top episodes kind of changed up this year. Every year, it's usually J.D. Salinger who makes the top of our list because he is our first episode. I cannot imagine what that's like to listen to now. I'd rather not. But Jim Harrison fans have come up and shown up for this man because he is our top episode this year, followed then by J.D. Salinger. Faulkner also has a good fan base. Eugene O'Neill, which I personally, that's one of my favorite episodes, so it makes me very happy that other people have enjoyed that one as much as we did recording. That was the one that we literally sat on a rock in the middle of the ocean and recorded on the ruins of the theater where Eugene O'Neill's plays were first performed in Provincetown. So that one has a lot of audio embellishment that is on it because of the ocean. Nathaniel Hawthorne came up at number 5, followed by Patricia Highsmith, Eudora Welty. She's bumped up. She's moving up in the ranks as well. The Bronte Sisters live episode is also doing very well. And then Susan Sontag, and I think for the first time, F. Scott Fitzgerald has made a reappearance. He's one of the only authors that we've profiled twice on the podcast, so I'm not sure if this is the original one or the new one.
But you added them together, I'm
okay,
sure.
They're fine. Yeah. Our cities with the most listeners, unsurprisingly, come from the Midwest. Thank you so much, Midwestern fans. We really appreciate you showing up for us. We've got Midwestern authors that we love to profile and Midwestern author and Midwestern fans. So Chicago takes our top spot, which makes sense, followed by specifically John and my parents from Naperville. there might be other listeners in Naperville, but we know there are at least 2. Arlington Heights then comes up, which is also very exciting. It's very near the school that I teach at. And then we went bi-coastal this year, which is also very cool. New York and Brooklyn took top spots, and then Los Angeles and Seattle have also made appearances on our most listened to cities this year. And then Des Moines. Can't knock out Des Moines.
That one I don't know.
Thank you, Des Moines.
Thank you, Des Moines. All my Des Moines.
This is Des Moines. So all told, across the world, we have listeners in over 3,500 cities, which is pretty wild to hear. And then we also have some country data, which is kind of interesting. Most of our listeners obviously come from the U.S. And other English-speaking countries, because that's where our content mostly sits. John and I are not proficient enough in any other language to even do more than pronounce the cities that we have here, but that's
even
fine.
That's rough for us sometimes.
But we've got USA, Canada, and the UK coming in at our top 3 spots, followed by Germany, the Netherlands, France, Austria, Ireland, and Sweden this year. So to all of those listeners all around the world, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is so cool to know that there is something about this podcast that speaks to you, which really, I think, goes to show us about the staying power of literature and the fact that regardless of where you come from or what you've read or what country you're from, there's something about literature that ties us all together. So it's really cool to see that all told, we have 119 countries that have listened to our podcast at some point in time, which is really cool. Jack did the math, and that means that over 60% of the countries in the world have listened to Gitlit Podcast.
Yes.
There you go. So it's always fun, again, to be able to do this podcast and to have all of the support that we do from friends and family who come to our live shows, to the friends who become like family that come to our live shows. We are so unbelievably grateful for all of you, for listening, for sending us in authors that we should do, for we've gotten some unboxing videos because you've sent us gifts and packages of things that, you know, if it's an old book that you're looking to get rid of, we are so happy to have it.
But it's, careful.
Yeah. I'm so happy to have it. We really just appreciate it. I think starting this, again, as an experiment, as a teaching tool, has become so much more. And I think every single week, knowing that we have this kind of place and community to touch base, it's helped John and I's friendship a lot. And even through the pandemic, when we were able to see each other every week, we had an opportunity to connect. And it's been a really cool opportunity for us to travel, for me to continue learning. I think as much as I love teaching, I also love still being a student. And I think GitLit really keeps me in that mindset because I have to research things every single week. And I learn new things about literary movements or authors that I never heard of. And so to know that I have a consistent space to keep learning that also hopefully brings other people joy feels like a real gift that I was never intending, and I'm beyond grateful that I have.
I completely agree with you, Stephanie, and thank you for all of that work that you've done in bringing these kind of lessons into our life. And I think for me, the fact that we focus on the biographies behind the authors, it gives us a lot of different ways to see how one could live, how one might live in different periods of world history. And so beyond the literature, which is, you know, what ties us together across both our listening audience, we're all interested in that, as well as our common humanity, we also get just different ways of seeing how people have navigated the same set of years that you're given through life. And that's been really interesting to see how people tackle it differently. So, you know, it puts our own lives in perspective, I think.
Definitely. Jack, your reflections? Wonderful. So I think with that being said, thank you so much for celebrating our fifth birthday with us. We are so happy to be here and look forward to many more years to come. Who knows if we have an expanded team with social media and website design in the future. Okay. Wonderful. So I guess we'll kick things off. We've got six different literary ladies to profile and put out into your purview. You may have heard of these authors. You may not have. Hopefully there is something new that you get a chance to learn today. But we're going to go ahead and be starting here with, we're going to ground ourselves in theater, and I'm very excited to be doing that because that's where I am happiest. Some of you might know Aphra Behn, everyone's favorite playwright, who was born in 1640 and died in 1689, everyone's favorite time period. You might know her for such work as The Rover. My theater history students do know that play because we've taken a look at it before. But she also wrote The City Heiress and then Orinoco. This is a really significant text that I'm happy to profile because it was one of the first pieces written by a white woman that portrayed the plight of specifically African slaves positively. It takes place from Orinoco's perspective and expands on his life and kind of legacy. And so it was very popular when it was published, but also, again, kind of revolutionized the way that African Americans were able to be portrayed in literature as we move through specifically the 1600s as a time period. So she was also known for her work as a spy, or more so a failed spy. She was not good at it. And that she was the very first woman to make a living that we know of from her writing. So quite the pioneer, which is really incredible. But those are the things that I think most people know. So how is she connected to London? Thank you so much for asking, everyone. So her favorite London activities included writing witty, chaotic, explicit, arguably smutty plays, which everyone also loves. She is writing in what we know today as the Restoration period, which comes to us right after Oliver Cromwell banned all theater, after his 18-year period kind of taking over England while it was in between kings, the interregnum. She came out and really became a significant figure in this time. So Oliver Cromwell, everyone's least favorite person, did ban all theater when he took power. And after he is overthrown, the Restoration period comes forth, and It unites the English, Scottish, and Irish monarchies under King Charles II in 1660. So this is a very important time because theater is now actually allowed to be back on stages again in the past, which for the last, 20 years or so was not the case. And so people start writing, but the writing that they're doing is completely unhinged. They said, we can't have theater for this long. We're going to bring it all to you. So lots of it rebels directly against the puritanical standards that Oliver Cromwell instituted in both not allowing theater, but also putting incredible restrictions on the social mobility of people and the cultural mobility that we have. So a lot of these plays and or shows would have really elaborate set designs. You get beautiful costumes from this time period, and a lot of risque humor, a lot of double entendre, a lot of illusion. Other famous plays from this time period include William Wycherley's The Country Wife, which is the version with Helen Mirren. I make my acting classes watch when I'm gone. I full bought the DVD because you can't find it anywhere. It's really good. If you would like to watch The Country Wife, watch that version of it. It is really great. And who doesn't love Helen Mirren?
And I can't blame the people in the Reformation period. I mean, you've been bottled up and not been allowed to express yourself on stage, which, you know, is one of the few ways where you congregate and then can perform in front of other people. And so there's an explosion of a want to connect and to profile all different aspects of life. So I kind of understand why it might have gone a little bit off the rails as we're coming back from the Reformation or into the Reformation. That's pretty cool.
Yes. We get to the Reformation, as I mentioned before, Aphra Behn was a spy. She was not a very good spy, but she was a spy before she became an author. Through a series of events, I believe she wound up in the Netherlands, but she actually fell in love with someone that she was supposed to be spying on. There was a conflict with money where King Charles couldn't afford to bring her back, so she was stuck there for a period of time. We outline all of this in our Aphra Behn specific episode. If you're interested, we talk a little bit more about that.
It's totally worth it. Like a longer, more detailed information about like a biography of Aphra Behn. It keeps you on the edge of your seat, I promise. And, I think it does a lot to raise her profile up to the level of the likes of, Ben Jonson and Shakespeare and Marlowe and some of her pseudo-contemporaries.
Yes, I agree with that. Her first play gets produced in London, so she doesn't start her playwriting career until she winds up getting back. It's called The Forced Marriage. Everyone's favorite play. And it tells the story of a heroine who's forced to marry someone she doesn't love, which is awful, and of course no one wants that, so we do want to play about how it goes wrong. So through a series of twists and turns, right, there are some brushes with infidelity, of course, as natural. There's a faked death. There are sword fights left, right, and center. All of the characters do wind up with the people that they love in the end, although it does take a while for them to get there. Behn is one of the only women, like I said earlier, to be getting paid to do her writing at the time. We know that there are other women writing during this time period, but it's really Aphra Behn who makes her full career and life out of getting paid to write plays, which is remarkable. The theater scene was also incredibly competitive during this time. It's one of the only forms of entertainment, right? You've obviously got going to pubs and watching fights and putting bets on them, and paying to watch chickens fight and putting bets on them, and bears also.
And you have, like, the less, like, established forms of entertainment, like minstrels, right, and wandering theater, and something that's not done where there is a set and maybe costumes or whatnot, like maybe more amateur productions, but... Mm-hmm. Like, the kind of writing that Behn is doing is meant to be on the stage and performed in this, I think, more elevated kind of atmosphere.
Yes, and seen by the public. Her plays are premiered at the Dorset Gardens Theatre, which is the resident home of the Duke's Players, which is the acting company that she writes for. Companies at this time also worked a little bit differently in that they were extremely competitive with one another. There were no copyright laws really during this time period, so regulation between theater companies didn't exist. If one theater company saw work that another playwright wrote, they might pop on over, take some notes, and write their own version of it and put it up a week later. So theater was pretty wild and, like I said, very competitive. So Aphra Behn succeeding in this realm, I think, really speaks to her staying power as a playwright, She wrote another play, the one, again, she's most famous for, I think, is The Rover. That's the one that gets the most studied, which, again, gives us this sort of ridiculous, swashbuckling, pirate-esque character. There are double crossings and women who fall in love and men who fall in love, and they don't fall in love with the right people at the right time. But these are all getting premiered with the Duke's Players, which is her resident company. It is initially helmed by Sir William Davenant. And then later, the great actor and manager, because people would usually do both things at the time, Thomas Betterton, comes up and takes it. And Ben will actually write a lot of her roles for him specifically, which, again, wasn't uncommon at the time. The playhouse, however, was torn down in 1707. There is a plaque, however, that you can find, I believe, today.
It's not. A plaque doesn't do it justice.
It doesn't. But it is hard, and the reason that I wanted to profile her not only is because she's incredible, and we don't have a ton of things that exist in London today that you can still see because they're from the 1600s. We had a lot of fires. There's a lot of money being tossed around. But I think she's definitely worth getting to know, and finding your way to trace her ghost through London is a really rewarding exercise, I think. Virginia Woolf was really interested in Afrobun as well. She will make her way to us later in this episode. But she writes, "All women together ought to let flowers fall upon the tomb of Afrobun, which is most scandalously, but rather appropriately, in Westminster Abbey. For it was she who earned them the right to speak their minds." End quote. I think that's an incredibly powerful quote to deliver regarding her legacy and her work, because she did so much for women, but also because I like the tongue-in-cheek. She's buried in a church, but definitely was not appreciated by the church while she was around. So I like that she makes her way into that sphere.
And maybe some context for why Virginia would even want to ask people to do this is that Afrobun doesn't have a legacy that stays high throughout time, and it's like it recedes shortly after her lifetime, and then more modern scholars around Virginia Woolf's time a little bit earlier sort of start to raise her profile again. And so I think in this A Room of One's Own, Virginia Woolf is saying, listen, you know, she, Afrobun, deserves our appreciation, and it's a benediction to really appreciate her for all that she did.
Yes. So go read a play, everybody. Go get an Afrobun play. And the nice part about her being so old is that you can find it all for free on the internet. Wonderful. So that, ultimately, Afrobun will become, during her time, the second most produced playwright behind the poet laureate John Dryden, which, again, at the time, I think really speaks volumes about her work. She wasn't just a remarkable playwright for a woman. She was a remarkable playwright, period, because her work was being produced more, if not, you know, just as much than her male counterparts at the time. So that is Afrobun. I think definitely worth studying. But we're going to go ahead and move along to Jane Austen, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Jane Austen is coming to us a little bit later, 1775 to 1817. Most people know her for such things as Pride and Prejudice. The remake, the other movie, the other remake of Pride and Prejudice. They know her from Sense and Sensibility and Emma and Persuasion, and the other two that no one really reads. She is a Sagittarius, so for those of you that are interested in the star signs of your authors. And Jane Austen didn't live in London, but she loved to visit London, which is why I thought she would make a good candidate for talking about in our episode. She lives in a place called Chawton for the last 8 years of her life. This is a lovely picture of it. But she would often go, and this is actually where you can see, like, the Jane Austen Museum, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She would actually go visit her brother in London quite a bit. Her brother Henry lived there. And she would, Jack and I spent more time than necessary doing the math on this. Chawton, for those of you that are curious about the geography, which it looks like many of you are, is southwest of London, and it's about an hour and 19 minutes by contemporary car. And based on our mathematics, which is likely flawed and deeply inaccurate, but could be right, it would take about 2 days to get to London from Chawton. So it was not an easy journey necessarily, because again, your modes of transportation were walking, a horse, or a horse and carriage, and that's about it. So approximately 2 days, because you wouldn't travel through the night. It's 14 hours if you really want to know.
14 hours and 38 minutes by 4 miles an hour.
Average.
Thank you very much.
Averaged out.
I am so proud of you too.
It would have been very entertaining for you to watch us do that.
So. Very good.
It was bad.
It was not. I was embarrassed. So she saw London. Jane Austen saw London as this place of extremely lavish entertainment and a high point in culture. She really, really loved it. Again, she would stay with her brother Henry when she was there. So I wanted to present to all of you today Jane Austen's trip to London from September 15th to 16th, 1813. We have a letter that she wrote to her sister, Cassie Cassandra. Here's the letter. I'll give you a moment to read it. For those of you joining us on Instagram Live, it's very cramped cursive. We'll post these, and you can give it a shot if you would like to read it yourself. But some highlights of how to do Austen like Jane London. You could
flip
go...
that. Oh. How to do London like Jane Austen.
What did I say?
How to do Austen like Jane London.
Oh, I like that better.
I did too.
Cut it. We'll edit it in post. We'll edit it. Please edit it. Okay, so if you wanted to do that how you wanted to do it with your book, you wanted to do it with, you could start with dinner. What do you eat for dinner? That's a wonderful question. Jane Austen thought she had a very comfortable dinner. She had soup, fish, partridge, and an apple tart. And that was the luxurious dinner that she got to indulge in London. She sat down after 5 p.m. So at 5 p.m., you guys are going to go and you're going to have that dinner. Okay. Later that night, you're going to go at 7 p.m. to the theater. You're going to take a coach. You're going to go to the Lyceum Theater, okay? It takes about 4.5 hours for you to do whatever is going on at the Lyceum, which would likely have been a show. Again, what else are you going to do? 4.5 hours of what? It's dark out. There's no electricity.
You don't go home to Netflix. There's no scrolling Instagram. Yeah.
So, 4.5 hours, although by today's audience standards, probably wasn't that bad. That was actually probably a really nice night at the theater.
I mean, Oppenheimer's twice that long.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
After you get back from the theater, you're going to have soup, wine, and water, and then you're going to go to your hole, which is what she describes her bedroom as.
I don't like that.
She called it a hole. It was supposed to be quaint.
Okay.
She then interrupts herself in her own letter to talk about how she's writing her own letter, and she writes, quote, "I must get a softer pen." Then there's a dash. "This is harder. Dash. I am in agonies." End quote. So she also wants her sister Cassandra to know exactly how she's feeling while she's writing her letter. The thing that I think is very interesting about the letter writing from this time period is that she sends this, right, this covers 2 days of her trip. She was there for much longer, but this covers 2 days from her trip. She would write things periodically. She wouldn't sit down and write the whole letter at once, necessarily. She'd go out, she'd do an activity, she'd write about it. She'd go out, do something else, she'd add it. So there is this really kind of like meta-commentary that happens while she's writing this letter over a period of time. Her mood and emotions change. And again, these are the things that we have from this time that tell us a little bit about the lives of the people who live them, and also how you would transmit your material and information. If you had no other way of communicating, these letters every 2 or 3 days would have been really nice for your family members to have at home. Otherwise, you know, when you got back from your trip 5 weeks later, then you would have to tell them everything. So this is kind of a really cool document of the day-to-day life that people would have experienced that we have.
Right, and it keeps them from worrying along the way. And specifically to the finding softer and harder pens, Aphra Behn as well as Jane Austen, you can imagine that there's not a lot of, like, ergonomic pen design at the moment, and you're using Inkwell and whatnot, and I mean, when you have to turn out the volume of letters written by hand, not a keyboard, it is the complaint of writers as they get older, is how much it hurts to actually write. So I think that there is a testament to still wanting to create so bad that you're willing to have that pain in your hand to put some words to the paper.
Cassandra had to know about the partridge.
She had to.
Yeah. She then decides that she's writing too long, so she writes, "I'm going to write in nothing but short sentences. There shall be 2 full stops in every line." And then she continues, but apparently forgets this rule because she says, let me be rational and return to my two full stops. So she keeps up with it. So after you've done that, you're going to go back to the theater again, okay? Then you're going to go get some new trim on your dress. You need to watch your colors, though. Jane Austen was afraid that the trim that they put on her outfit would make her look too pale. So she wrote about that to her sister. She then also had to go to the dentist. She didn't like it, and she cried. So I hope that doesn't become part of your trip, but that is what she wrote home. She went to the theater again, and then she went shopping and got a bonnet fitted. She was very happy with the bonnet, and it just sounds like a delightful time. So if you're looking for a tour of London based on Jane Austen, that is that for all of you.
And you get to come away with a new bonnet, as I'm sure we're all wearing ours thin.
So the next author that I'd love to profile is Mary Shelley, everyone's favorite goth girl. She is known for such things as Frankenstein.
The end.
If you are very interested in Mary Shelley, you know she did write other novels. She also wrote poetry, and she also was the preserver of her husband's legacy, Percy Shelley. She spent a lot of her later adult years putting his work and making sure that it received the recognition it deserved and was preserved, which is annoying because I don't think any of you can name a Percy Shelley poem, but we can all name Frankenstein, just saying.
And Mary Shelley was so committed to Percy that she kept his heart very close to her, both figuratively but also literally, in that she kept his calcified heart in her desk. So that was always there for her as well.
She would eventually be cremated with it, if you were wondering.
Yeah.
I know you were. So Mary's favorite spot in London is actually a cemetery. And this has it's a little quirky. Unfortunately, Mary Shelley's mother dies 11 days after she is born. Her favorite spot was visiting her mother's grave, which is at St. Pancras Old Church Garden in Camden in London. So you can obviously go see this today if you too would like to stop by Mary Shelley's favorite spot. It was her favorite spot for a lot of different reasons. Her father, who is the reformist writer and philosopher William Godwin, takes her to the churchyard when she is a young child, and she continues to visit on her own. She would read work there, she would take books and things like that, and spend quite a bit of time with her mother's grave, that kind of thing. She felt very, I think, connected to her in that capacity. I thought it was sort of interesting. One of the things that I was reading while I was doing this research was that Mary Shelley didn't have a dead mother. She had a tombstone for a mother. And I thought that was an interesting quote, especially because once her father remarried, she was not a fan of her stepmom, who was just a neighbor. And so she left home even more frequently to spend more time in the cemetery. Again, reading, doing all kinds of stuff. I'm guessing it was a very peaceful place to be. Conventions, again, around this time in death are very different than the ones that we have now, so I think that's also worth positing. We have, a very sterile and distant relationship to death. Once a person in our life dies, there's sort of the procedure that you go through, and then you kind of remove yourself from the situation. Mourning customs throughout history, I think, are very compelling and interesting, and would have felt a little bit different than we know. So although for us, I think, as a modern audience, it might feel kind of strange, like, she would just go sit on the grave. That to them, I don't know, would have been as unusual a construct.
Right. And I mean, even as we were doing this audiobook for Christmas Carol, there's a scene when it's the alternate world in which Tiny Tim dies, that there's this tableau where we actually see Bob Cratchit with the body of his son up in their room, and they're just keeping him there a couple of days to mourn him. And again, just a different relationship to death than I think what we're used to now.
Yes. It will get different and a little weird, though, because she meets Percy Shelley, who is this kind of, like, golden boy of the intellectual movement at the time. And he's very popular in the intellectual circles and things like that. So they obviously went on dates in the graveyard. They would go for walks in the graveyard. They would hang out in the graveyard. They profess their love to each other, verbally and physically, in the graveyard.
Okay, I'm getting it now.
There is more to that story. If you are interested in that, you can go look it up later for yourself. Yes, so although there are a lot of circumstances around this, right, around the graveyard and around her being part of the graveyard and taking Percy to the graveyard and doing other things in the graveyard, it seemed, I think, for Mary to be this really incredible space of fusion. In this capacity, she was able to connect herself to her family history. She's able to pursue the things that she's interested in intellectually and kind of have that guidance that, again, she never got from her mother. This will factor prominently in Frankenstein. So for those of you that are interested in Frankenstein, there are a lot of modern commentaries and interpretations of it, of course, but I think the thing that's most interesting is the commentary about loss. Mary Shelley not only lost her mother at a very early age, but just a few years prior to writing it, she'd also lost a child herself. And so to know that these kind of interweave themselves make this graveyard a really compelling place. So if you're looking for London through Mary Shelley's eyes, I would recommend a trip to the graveyard.
I think also the understanding that this death force had so much pull on her, the idea of creating a novel in which life can be bestowed upon something almost feels like a wish fulfillment for mm-hmm. her. Like, there is no way to get these people back, but if I could, like, I know that's not a theme that's explored, you know, directly in Frankenstein, but you have to wonder if maybe that mechanism isn't something that she was so interested in playing with.
Yeah. I think your use of mechanical language is also interesting in that capacity as a sci-fi exploration of the book.
Sure.
Yes, so would recommend Frankenstein. Absolutely. And also take a look at some of her poetry. I would recommend that too. You get another side of her and her work. We're going to go ahead and move on to Mary Seacole, who I'm very excited to be profiling. She does not have a full episode in Gitlet's canon yet, but maybe this could be a cool introduction. Mary Seacole was born in 1805, and she is known actually as a self-described doctress, which I think is a really cool title. Women, of course, during this time period could not be doctors, of course. But she owned the title Doctress, which I think is really cool. And she is also known for writing her autobiography, The Wonderful Adventures of Mrs. Seacole, which I think is very nice. We don't also have her star sign. Her birth date is disputed even by herself, depending on what time she was operating under and who she was with. She actually changed her birthday by a couple years. And she writes, quote, "As a female and a widow," spoiler alert, "I may be well excused giving the precise dates of this important event. But I do not mind confessing that the century and myself were both young together and that we have both grown side by side into age and consequence." So, she didn't feel she needed to disclose her age, which I thought was very cool.
If you need to beg someone off the question of age, I think that's a perfect line.
Yes.
I started the century young and we've grown old side by side together.
Into age and consequence.
Into age and consequence.
Yes.
Beautiful.
So Mary Seacole is actually from Jamaica. She was born in Jamaica, although Jamaica at this time was under British rule, so she has British citizenship. Citizenship. And her father was actually Scottish member of the military. Her mother identified as Creole, which was a blend of cultures. Often a lot of people from a mixed race background might identify as Creole from this specific part of the world. For those of you that have been down to Louisiana and or the South, Creole culture is very prominent. And a celebration, it has its own dialect, it has its own culture. And so Mary Seacole is very proud of her heritage. She never explicitly identified herself as Black, but race was something that she did write about and consider, and it would have unfortunate consequences on her life in opening up the opportunities that she had and didn't have respectively. So she grew up with her mother primarily. Her mom was also, a doctress in traditional medicine. She was very involved and engaged in traditional medicine practices at the time, which involved herbalism and other what we might consider today alternative medical practices, which I think is kind of a dangerous word to use because it discredits the preservation and benefits of these traditional medicine practices. So she grew up practicing these traditional medicine techniques on her dolls. She saw what her mom did. She practiced them on her own dolls and toys, which I thought was very cool. But she was also fascinated by London. She grew up thinking about London and knowing about London. And when she was a teenager, she actually had the opportunity to go to London twice. She spent a total of 3 years throughout the course of her teenage years exploring London, which is very cool. That, for those who are interested, is an arduous 8-week trip on a boat, which is about 2 months. So if you're interested in getting from Jamaica to London during this time period, you're looking at a 2-month commitment. About 1/6 of your year would be dedicated to traveling to London.
Oh my gosh. And I'm guessing she would have done it multiple times throughout her life as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would be a traveler at that time. I'll be honest with you. That's quite a commitment. And to be out in the open sea for that long, I don't know if I have the stomach for it.
I think a lot of people would agree with you. And that's actually why things like armchair travel became really, really popular. People didn't have the money or the ability to travel during this time. So that's why travel memoirs and books that were written by people who did get to travel were really popular, because you didn't actually need to know or need to go to those places. You could just take the book and read it, and it was like you were going on your own adventure. So she went on an adventure to Panama. She got involved with the gold prospecting trade, naturally. And then in the autumn of 1854, she travels back to London. It wasn't super profitable, so I guess she wasn't a particularly good prospector, but, like, who was? Is that, how do you develop that skill set? I don't know. So she invests this gold into the stock market, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah.
I don't know how to invest my gold into the stock market, so it was neat that she did that. And this is where she starts picking up and attempting to start her nursing career. Unfortunately, she doesn't have the technical background that a lot of the doctor's offices and practicing spaces would require to become a fully fledged nurse, but she has all of this experience. Now, I also realized while doing the research for this time that I don't know much about the Crimean War. Do we have any experts about the Crimean War in the room? Good. Okay.
Right here. You're our new experts.
Great. If we need to edit out this entire section, we can later. No. So she actually goes off to Crimea to help. This is a peninsula that's just south of Ukraine and north of Turkey in the Black Sea. You know this. And she sets up what she calls the British Hotel. This is not a hotel for boarding, right? Like, not a vacation spot, obviously. It's a war zone. And she sets up this British hotel between Sevastopol and Baklava in this peninsula. And it functions as kind of this dual space. It's like kind of part canteen. She would cook and prepare meals, healthful meals for soldiers recovering from their injuries, but would also use it as a care space. When soldiers were brought in, again, she's supporting the British Empire during this time. It didn't really matter to her, though. She was truly, I think, the kind of medical practitioner that regardless of what side you were on, she was going to treat and help you. And so she would do all kinds of work with this. She served on the front lines, was actually the first woman to do so during this war. She helped out Florence Nightingale when she needed help. Many people know Florence Nightingale's legacy as a nurse. During this time period. So this was all really part of what she did. She got back to London after the war. She's also 40, or she's in her 50s now.
Oh, wow.
At this point. So she goes over in her 40s, which was another reason, in addition to the race complications that she faced, that prevented people from taking her seriously. She's too old. She's not white enough to be with these other nurses. We don't need her. But her work quickly spoke for itself in that capacity. She was able to treat and care for hundreds of soldiers who would later be able to make the trip home to their families in London after the war. This will factor in later, which is why I'm putting this in here now. But I think it's noted that she not only was incredibly good at what she did, but faced immense barriers, both personally and professionally, to help people and continue to do it anyway.
It makes it a lot more of a brave statement to set up this hotel as well, in understanding that there's no institution with which is imbuing her with any type of resources or any credibility. She is on her own setting this up and just helping the people who need it in a war zone. I think that that marks her as a very brave woman.
Yes, and quite literally her own resources. She spent her own money to do this work. She helped build the hospital hotel actually out of things like driftwood and pieces of broken ships came together. She pulled all of that to create the structures that helped save lives.
Wow.
So after she returns to London, she writes down her adventures, and again called The Wonderful Adventures of Mrs. Seacole in Many Lands. Which I thought, again, was kind of a remarkable title, and is actually one of the first memoirs, specifically travel memoirs, ever published by a black woman. Everyone loved it. It did very, very well. It was very successful right from the get-go. It quickly runs into a second printing, which isn't always guaranteed, so that another remarkable thing. And Queen Victoria, the future King Edward the VII, and his brother, the Duke of Edinburgh, helped fund the Seacole Fund, which allowed her to live comfortably for the rest of her life.
Wow.
She, again, got back from using all of her personal resources in the war and came back and was, her business partner that she was in with wasn't very good with money, so that also got in the way.
Like, for a business partner, are there other attributes you're looking for other than good with money? I feel like that is the top of the list.
To be fair, that's your job.
Oh. And I'm not very good at it either.
How long did our carriage map take us? Like, this is on you.
Okay,
yeah.
Understood. Yeah.
This is your
fault. Okay. I have one more day for our taxes.
Okay. Great. It's fine, right?
Everything's good.
Right. Gitlet ended at its fifth season. the Seacole Fund is established and founded to provide her with an income for the rest of her life. She dies of a stroke on May 14th, 1881, at 76 years old. And you can go see her gravesite, actually, which I think, again, is very remarkable. So her life and legacy kind of pulled her all over London, but I really wanted to feature her because London was such a significant city for Mary Seacole, and she needs, I think, a lot more credit than we initially have been giving her, historically speaking. So that is Mary Seacole. Our next author, second to last author, I think, is Virginia Woolf. And many people know Virginia Woolf from Mrs. Dalloway to The Lighthouse, A Room of One's Own, my personal favorite called Orlando. She is an Aquarius as well. And her favorite London hobby, if you want to do London like Virginia Woolf did, would be through her own personal invention of street hauntings. So I really like this term. You can go street haunting if you want, which is just going for a walk in London. And she liked this idea so much that she wrote an essay about it. Again, you can go read that online. There are beautiful cloth-bound editions, which you can see in the slide, that you can purchase if you're interested in that. But you can go read it for free if you would like. And she writes this really sort of interesting stream of conscious essay about street haunting when she goes out for a walk. I wanted to read the opening line because I felt that you, John, and Jack would both really enjoy it. And it goes, or reads, quote, "No one, perhaps, has ever felt passionately towards a lead pencil. But there are circumstances in which it can become supremely desirable to possess one. Moments when we are set up upon having an object, an excuse for walking half across London between tea and dinner." End quote. So yes, you heard correctly. Her street haunting guise was that she was going to go buy a pencil, and she really needed one. So she had to go out and street haunt for it, which I think is very cool.
That was her excuse.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I have to go walk the dog. No, it's I have to go buy a pencil. I think there's a small subset of people for which that is like a reasonable excuse, and you're one of them, Stephanie.
I think, so for me, it wouldn't be a pencil. Bic crystal blue ink pen.
Yes, of course. Yeah. You're right. Excuse me.
But for those of you that need the endeavor, find a favorite pen or pencil and make that your reason to go exploring. You can go street haunting like Virginia Woolf. So many people, poetical romantics, have gone out and traced the journey. Again, it's kind of rambling. Some of the sites that she references is in this essay don't exist anymore, because they've been bought up by like a KFC or something like that. But some of it you can go around and see. And there are a lot of people who've gone out and blogged about it. They've found their own version of her route. So I thought I would pull some highlights for you if you're interested. But the first thing, once you leave your house, which is obviously the same house that Virginia Woolf was leaving, you'll go through Russell Square. And Russell Square, according to the internet, is a, quote, large Georgian square with a statue of the founder, the Duke of Bedford, plaza and water feature. It's also good for kids and dogs are allowed. So you can go to Russell Square if you are interested in those things. She then takes an opportunity to visit a secondhand bookshop and delivers a beautiful quote about books that I thought was worth reading here. And she describes secondhand bookshops as, quote, "Secondhand books are wild books, homeless books. They have come together in vast flocks of variegated feather," end quote.
The flocks and feather. Oh,
I know.
My. Yeah, what is that? What's an illusion? Is it a metaphor? Where are we?
Audience?
Alliteration.
Identify the literary device.
Vast
that's
flocks
not
of variegated feather?
Yeah.
Metaphor.
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 Yeah.
Metaphor.
You can just sort of show the recording of this to your classes, English classes, and
yeah.
Like, spot the device.
That's right.
They would be like, onomatopoeia, because that's their favorite one. it's not an onomatopoeia. Then you're going to walk down Bedford Place and New Oxford Way, which again are two streets of London that are kind of mixed-use residential and commercial spaces. They all follow kind of a linear trajectory, so you kind of run one right into the other. Then you're going to come across on New Oxford Way James Smith and Sons.
Umbrellas?
Yes. It was established in 1830, and it sells, quote, "umbrellas, parasols, and walking sticks in handsome original Victorian in our handsome original Victorian shop." So, if you were ever interested in going to an umbrella store, don't worry, that exists.
See, this is something we lose in the department stores. You don't have to walk down the street to the umbrella shop.
I know. I just thought this was beautiful. It, again, has been there since 1830. You can go see it today. These are all contemporary pictures culled from the internet. But I think, again, just kind of a really compelling time capsule, right? The idea that, like, an umbrella would be something that you would go seek out specifically because you like the look or the design. I think we're very blasé with our umbrellas today because we'll get, you know, they can get left in a store and we don't really care. A lot of us don't notice. Many of us probably have an umbrella sitting in the back of our car collecting dust. I forego them and just run it rains because it's, I don't like holding an umbrella. But I think the fact that this store has existed for so long kind of tells us a little bit of something about the value of an umbrella. Who knew?
We will not be held up by weather, and it goes back as far as 1830 to the umbrella shop.
Yes, or walking stick, et cetera, et cetera.
Et cetera,
et cetera. So you can go visit that today. You're then going to encounter Seven Dials, which is kind of this large intersection, which will take you through Covent Garden neighborhood. And then you're going to wind up at the Strand and end up at the Thames, the river. The Strand is, of course, the kind of main thoroughfare, the link between Westminster, which is where all of the governmental spaces in London are housed, and London proper. And hopefully, in the end, you'll wind up finding a pencil. So, of course, there are many places that you could go to today to tour, but I think this, again, is a very remarkable version of this and a delightful way to see London like Virginia Woolf might have. So that is her street hauntings, and I wish any of you who do like to go walk many other street hauntings. It does not have to just be London. You can haunt the streets of your own hometown if you like. Great. So the final author that we're going to profile for you today to give you another glimpse into what life in London might have been like is Agatha Christie. And I would also like to just take a second to promote that we actually have an author in the room today who has written this wonderful book, Agatha Annotated, Investigating the Books of 1920. This is available for sale at the Pyle Bookstore. This, I think, is remarkable. Kate Gingold is in the back today if you guys are interested in doing so. Yes, please applaud. And when I found out that she would be here, I got very, very nervous. So, Kate, feel free to just pop on up here. The mic is very portable, and you are more than welcome to do that. But
you're doing wonderfully.
Thank you. You are, congratulations on your book, and I know there are other of your books for sale here as well. So at the end of this, again, folks, feel free. You'll have an opportunity to do some shopping if you would like. But her books are for sale, and we'll explore a lot more in depth the life legacy of Agatha Christie. So Agatha Christie is known for such things as Murder on the Orient Express, Death of the Nile, my personal favorite, The Mysterious Affair at Styles. She actually shares a very important birthday on September 15th with John. So John and Agatha Christie have the same birthday. Are we having technical
difficulties? We are having technical difficulties.
Oh, good. And I actually can't see them, so this is great. And everything looks fine to me. So while we're resetting ourselves, is it fine? Is it fine? It's fine. Okay. Everything's fine.
Perfect.
Edited out in post. Okay. So Agatha Christie is a Virgo. Good for her. Her favorite parts of London include lots of different places. She is maybe our most... clearly connected to London because she lived there for much of her life and lots of her legacy is still left there. She's also contemporary enough that many of these things you can actually see today. So that's kind of nice. But she started going to London when she was very little. She was born in a suburb but came with her beloved Auntie Granny to take all kinds of adventures throughout London. This was an older relative, and she would take her to see different productions at famous West End theaters. They would go shopping. They would do all kinds of fun things. So that was young Agatha's exposure to London when she was a young person. And one of the most exciting things she got to do in 1901, it was the first day of the first electric tram. You can ooh. Thank you. So this electric tram starts its service, and 11-year-old Agatha Christie is able to write a poem about it, which is very remarkable. The pictures, although, I mean, what is more exciting than that, folks? What a tram.
The hats are really what I can't get over.
I'm just scared that they let people stand on the roof.
That's true.
Uncovered.
No, there's chairs. I still
well,
I don't
they're
know.
Not sitting.
Oh, they're not sitting.
I'm in the lower picture. Ooh. So, again, having just taken a group of students to New York City, the idea that they would be standing on the top of a bus driving through New York is horrifying to me. So young Agatha really gets a kick out of being able to drive and ride on the tram. And so she writes her poem. This is the first time that she actually appears in print, so which is kind of cool. And she wrote, quote, "When first the electric trams did run in all their scarlet glory, 'twas well, but ere the day was done, it was another story."
Uh-oh. Uh-oh, what happened?
So, that, I think they probably just didn't, like, run at night.
Yeah, oh, okay. Maybe. Oh, I thought something went bad, like someone shouldn't have been standing, like, up at the top deck.
Yeah. So, she has this lovely connection to the trams, which I think is very, very cool. But one of her other passions, other than murder, was houses. Agatha Christie was very passionate about houses. She had many different London residences that, again, you can go see today. You can't necessarily go in them, but most of them have, like, a plaque labeling them. And she had lots of different houses in London throughout the course of her life there. Her quote about houses that started, she had a lot of joy when she was young with her dollhouses. She really liked dollhouses, and she played with them. But this was her reflection on houses. She wrote, quote, "I can see quite plainly now that I've continued to play house ever since," her childhood. "I have gone over innumerable houses, bought houses, exchanged them for other houses, furnished houses, decorated houses, made structural alterations to the houses. Houses! God bless houses." End quote.
So, I'm surprised because she was traveling a lot, especially with her second husband, that she would have such a connection to a place and a structure. But it's cool that she loves houses.
Right?
Yeah, I guess.
It would be very, very close friends.
Agatha Christie and I would be friends, I think. Yes, I agree. Well, I just thought it was nice that she referenced structural alterations to houses. She, like, could have maybe been an engineer.
Yeah, she could have been a client, Stephanie.
For those that are interested, John does not do homes. I've asked. So I wanted to highlight one house in particular that I thought was very quaint and very cute. This is 22 Cresswell, which is in Chelsea and neighborhood. You can see it's very cute. It's very charming. And although Agatha Christie would own many different houses, this is one she actually kept throughout her entire life. So this was a very special house to her. It, again, you can see very quaint, very cute. That top floor is actually her writing room, which who doesn't want a writing room in their house? That's so fun and so exciting. And I thought it was, again, worth profiling. You can go see it today. And I've zoomed in a little bit in the bottom right corner, again, on the plaque that you'll see. Lots of places in London are denoted by these small blue plaques that illustrate or mark where someone significant did something. In this case, Agatha Christie lived, and that was significant. So I also wanted to talk about another place that was important to Agatha. And this is the Apothecary Hall. The Apothecary Hall is kind of also has a very interesting history. It is actually a space that you can rent today, and it is still in use. But during the First World War, Agatha Christie was actually very interested in becoming a qualified pharmaceutical assistant. So writing wasn't necessarily the first thing that she thought of doing. She wanted to be a pharmaceutical assistant.
Knowing her proclivities, I'd be very concerned about being the person given the pharmaceuticals that she had handled.
This will come up later.
Okay.
So she needs to take an exam, though, of course, right? You don't want anyone just handing out drugs in any way. So in 1917, she sits down in the Great Hall where they still take the exams today, which I think is very cool. And she has to take three papers or complete these three papers. She passes the two oral exams in chemistry and materia medica, which are the properties of substances used in medicine. Obviously. I don't really know what an oral exam in either of those look like, but that sounds hard.
What is this ether? That's it. That's all I can guess. That's all I got for you.
What is a mole?
That's right.
So unfortunately, she doesn't actually pass the practical pharmaceutical exam that she needs to take, but she does retake it a couple months later, and she is successful the second time, which is very exciting. So she goes to Torquay to work with dangerous poisons.
Very good.
Yes.
That's what does.
So much fun. So she actually realizes after she's able to do this that she doesn't really want to be in the pharmacy field. She does not like it. But all of the work that she does during her training collectively comes in handy during her career as a crime writer. If you are a big Agatha Christie fan, you will maybe know that she makes references to over 80 poisonings in her books. So if anything, it's a very lucrative exam that she took, a very necessary...
It definitely grounds the books in reality.
Yes.
Like,
yeah, she knew what she was talking about in more ways than one. And I wanted to conclude here by mentioning St. Martin's Theater, which is also, this is a place that I'm personally very interested in because it's a theater. So many people also know The Mousetrap, which is Agatha Christie's most famous play. It's also the longest running play in the history of the world. Probably. And
actually, no.
Yeah, no, like, actually it is.
Yes.
I don't know how long, like, I don't know. No, I can't even think. I was trying to make, like, a reference to, like, Greek theater, but they just did, like, one and done. They didn't even have runs. Okay, so Christie actually originally writes The Mousetrap as a radio play for the birthday of King George V and Queen Mary, which I did not know. I thought that was very cool. It originally opens at the Ambassador's Theater, but then transfers to the St. Martin's Theater, where it still runs today, taking a pause only for the pandemic. And it has been performed for the last 70 years, as you can see in the bright neon sign that they hung on the front of the building. And
wow.
Isn't that cool?
I mean, Phantom, eat your heart out, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Who is she?
Yeah, right.
Who is she? 35 years.
35 years.
Something
what
like that.
That.
So in the lobby of the theater, which is the smaller picture on the lower right-hand corner, you can actually find the official board that states how many shows have been performed to date. which I think is very remarkable, and you can still go see this today. So there are tons of places to do London, like Agatha Christie, and see her work and things like that in that capacity. But she will officially round out our six literary ladies of London. And now, the games. I'm going to turn things over to John. So we are on a shared document. I did not cheat. I did not look at these at all. I always get very excited for John's games, and so I'm really looking forward to whatever it is that you chose to do.
You stay. Because also now we have people on the live that can also participate, and I don't know if John knows how to operate an iPhone.
Nope.
Or a phone.
Or a phone in general.
Okay.
Well, after we've had all of this knowledge that has just come to us from all of the research that's been done, I promise very little of it is going to help you with this trivia. We are going to talk about these famous literary ladies of London that we've just profiled, but maybe on a more trivial note. So I'm going to call this... Well, thank you for all of the information that you've given to us, Stephanie. And after we've had all of this information flow through us, we're ready to maybe take it on a little lighter note. And I promise that all the trivia that we're going to be doing has very little to do with what we've just learned. But with the frivolous nature of what we're about to embark on, I've called this section High Tea Trivialities. Our first question, our first game, is called Future Postcards from London, in hopes that maybe one day we go there and give some audio postcards back to our listeners. Which of the following places can you still visit in London? There may be more than one right answer.
Uh-oh.
First, Fleet Prison, where Aphra Behn was imprisoned for debt.
So fun.
Is it still there? B. 23 Hans Place, where Austen stayed while preparing her novel Emma for publication. C. St. Pancras Cemetery, where the Shelleys planned their elopement. Or D. 99 Uxbridge Road, where Christie often visited her auntie granny. So do we have any guesses? Does anyone think A is still here? No one. Anyone think B is still here? Hans Place, Austen State. How about C with the cemetery?
Yes, yes,
very
yes.
Good. We listened. And then D, what do we think? Do we think Christie's auntie's home is still there?
No.
Okay. Well, you're all right. There was one correct one. And what happened to the other ones? The prison was actually first destroyed by a riot, but then they rebuilt it, and then they finally demolished it, and they said that there was, like, I don't know, 7 million tons of bricks they ended up reclaiming from the prison, so I thought that was kind of cool. The middle one is where Jane Austen stayed during her finishing up of Emma. It's been redeveloped, and it does not look like that anymore. And then finally, Christie's auntie's home is now office buildings. But
it's very ugly. I did look up a picture. I was, like, trying to find some of these places. And it's, like, the most benign and ugly-looking office building you've ever seen. It's very sad.
I'm sorry. But the one that's still there is the grave. And so I think we shared a picture of this one. Very good. Nice job, everyone. The next game is called Over or Under. When did our literary ladies first set foot in London? Okay. So our first one is Jane Austen. Do we think that she was older than 12 or younger than 12 when Jane Austen first went into London? Who thinks under 12? Okay, we have some hands. Who thinks she was older than 12?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. The answer, she was 5 years old. 5 years old. And as most young people... Yeah, Miss John. As most young people on their first trip to London, the family was there to solicit money from family members because they lived on the patronage of their family. So that's why Jane was being taken around as, I think, a very cute 5-year-old. That's where you get the money. So I also think that this parasol in this painting is just absolutely great.
She must have gone to James Smith and Sons.
She might have.
Yeah.
Smith and Sons.
Next, Mary Seacole, over or under 15 years old. What do you think? Do we think that she is older than 15 when she went? Okay, anyone think younger than 15? Okay, very good. The answer, over but only by a year, is 16 years old. So she came there from Jamaica, and she came back the next year, and after learning what she did about London, bought pickled preserves and jams to sell there. So this is an enterprising woman. She is making her hotel. She is writing a book. She is
selling pickles.
She's selling pickles in London. It's Mary Seacole. All right, very good. Virginia Woolf, 3 years. Do we think that Virginia Woolf was older or younger than 3 years? Who thinks older than 3 years? No one. Who thinks younger than 3 years? And you're right, she was born there.
Trick question.
It is a trick question. And that is a very young Virginia Woolf with her mother. Nice job, everyone, over or under. The next game is called Missed London Connections. How likely is it that our literary ladies met one another in London? Our first pairing, Aphra Behn and Virginia Woolf.
Zero.
It's impossible. You're all right. But as Stephanie profiled earlier, I think Virginia really would have loved to meet Aphra Behn, as you can tell from the quote that was profiled in a room of one's own. So in my magical world, I hope that they were able to meet there in some way. The next set, Jane Austen and Mary Shelley. I'll give you, their lifespans did overlap. So what do we think? Who thinks that they may have met? Who thinks no way? We don't know. People have talked about it for a long time. They're hoping that maybe they have crossed paths at some point, but neither of them in either of their personal documents mention one another. So unfortunately, it doesn't sound like even if they did meet, it was a very large impact on either of them.
Jane Austen doesn't give, like, graveyard vibes, really, so I feel like it'd be hard for them to, like, cross paths.
For sure.
Interesting. Interesting.
And then Virginia Woolf and Agatha Christie, whose timelines did overlap. Who thinks it was likely that they may have met?
Yeah.
All right, who thinks not so likely? Okay, the answer is we also don't know. However, Vita Sackville-West makes an explicit reference to Christie in a letter to Virginia, and they're talking about the time when Agatha Christie goes mysteriously missing for a couple days in this, like, very local part of England, and the joke that Vita Sackville-West makes to Virginia Woolf is that they should do the same and just disappear to a small part of England together. So I thought that that was a maybe. They at least knew about each other and were contemporaries.
Can I posit a Gitlet conspiracy?
Please.
So we know that Agatha Christie went missing for a couple of days. We do not know why. We do not know what happened to her during that time. There is a very fun movie if you are interested in going to watch it. I don't know what it's called, but it's not that hard to Google. in which Agatha Christie apparently gets called out to solve a, like investigate something, and then a murder happens and she has to like solve the murder. And it's like, it's a very cool film. It's a really fun, like cool premise for a movie. So my thought is that Agatha Christie gets called out maybe to solve a murder that like Virginia Woolf was involved in. And because of the high profile of both figures, they couldn't reveal that information. Thus, no one spoke about why Agatha Christie went missing, but maybe it was to help Virginia Woolf out.
That would be an amazing comedy duo movie.
That would be like, who's, what if we did like Kristen Wiig
you
and
should be
Melissa
afraid
McCarthy?
Of Virginia Woolf. What if that's what it's called? You should be afraid of Virginia Woolf, and it's Agatha Christie helping her plan a murder.
Yes.
All right.
Was Sherlock Holmes a contemporary?
A little bit before.
A little bit before.
Yes. But yes. So Sherlock came before Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot.
Well, that's our London Miss Connections. I'm sorry I don't have a dead ringer for anyone, but it's fun to think about it. And then the last one is called That's What She Said, London Edition. Which of our literary ladies wrote the following quotes about London? The truth is that in London, it is always a sickly season. No one is healthy in London. Nobody can be. So, does anyone shout out a name of whatever author you think might have wrote this?
Virginia Woolf.
The first one, Aphra Behn, maybe. Okay, the answer is Jane Austen. It comes right out of Emma. So that's something from Emma. All right, number two. No, Doctor, I'm going to London. If things happen anywhere, they happen in London. So who's thinking Agatha. London's the center of the world?
Agatha
Christie, all right. That's, oh, sorry, and that's right, it is Agatha. Good job. The man in the brown suit is what that's from. And then I just loved it. I loved this as a book jacket cover. It just, there's so many questions. I have so many, like, she's dressed so chicly to be in the underground, and I always think of, is this a Miss Marple? No, it's not, okay. All right, our third quote. Women in London are like the rich silks. They are out of fashion a great while before they wear out.
Oh.
I do not think that's a very generous read on women in London, but it's written by one of our literary ladies. Any guesses on who wrote that one?
Virginia Woolf,
maybe. It was Aphra Behn, and it comes from Orinoco.
Excellent.
And that's what Orinoco looked like. Last but not least, the streets of London have their map, but our passions are uncharted. What are you going to meet if you turn this corner?
That's so cool. Well, that's Virginia Woolf.
Virginia Woolf. Very good. Yeah. And that's from Jacob's room.
So,
congratulations. You've made it through the IT trivialities. You've made it through all of six of our great literary London women. And, oh, Jacob's room. And that's the end of the games that I have for you.
So we'll go ahead and wrap things up here, but I wanted again to give a shout out. Thanks everybody who joined us on Instagram Live. How fun is this? I don't actually know what happens to this after, but...
I can, like, take this and post it to an archive, or we can just get rid of it.
Okay. But to all of you who came out today, it's a beautiful day in Chicago, which means that when our weather is at a premium, I know it can be hard to sit inside. But thank you so much for coming out to support a local bookstore. Thank you so much for coming out to support a local podcast. But doing this is a great joy. And so we're delighted to have all of you here for our fifth birthday and for our live show in a bookstore. It's always a delight. And we very much appreciate having you here. So I'm going to ask you guys, we'll edit this out in post, to help us with our tagline. If you are a consistent listener, you might know that at the end of every episode, I say thank you so much for your support of this podcast, and thank you as always for keeping it lit. So I would love for all of you to say keeping it lit when I get to that part of the line. So can we try that? We'll rehearse. Can everyone just say keeping it lit on three? One, two, three. Excellent. Okay, so now I'll actually do the line, you'll do the line, and then we'll cheer and everything will be good. Okay? So, thank you again so much to the Pyle Bookstore for hosting us today. Please go out and support them, and any local bookstore in your community is a wonderful place to get the books that we've referenced today or talked about, which we are delighted to share with all of you. So, with all of that on the table, thank you so much for your support of this podcast, and thank you, as always,
for keeping it lit.